If anybody has any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them.
Thank you.
Theurgic power of the Quran. Imam Ali, by the way, I refer to his sayings quite frequently in my writings now. I've been working on Imam Ali for quite a long time, and he's of particular significance for the understanding of metaphysics in Islam. Fritjof Schuon referred to him as the esoteric representative par excellence of Islam. And there are several sayings which fully substantiate that claim. Imam Ali says that God has revealed himself, manifested himself, disclosed himself. We need all these ideas to translate this word tajalli, which explains theurgy in relation to the Quran. Imam Ali says that God has made himself manifest, disclosed himself, revealed himself through the Quran to his creatures, but they do not perceive it. He also says that God has disclosed himself, revealed himself, has done this tajalli to his creatures by means of his creatures, but we don't perceive it. He also says in one of his poems that you think that you are an insignificant speck of dust, but within you is enfolded the greatest cosmos, al-alam al-akbar. So you are the clear book, فَأَنْتَ الْكِتَابُ الْمُبِينُ أَلَّذِي بِأَحْرُفِهِ يُطْفِرْ أَمُدْمَةً. So you are the clear book, the book that is clear by its nature and which clarifies through its luminosity. And this kitab mubin is how the Quran refers to itself. So we have these three ideas of God's self-disclosure through the Quran and implicitly through all of the revelations, all the scriptural revelations of God. It's not just the Quran. Rusbihan has a wonderful saying in which he describes one of his visions. And he says that in this vision I was taken to paradise, and David gave me the Psalms to taste, bulk. And Jesus gave me the Gospels to taste, and Muhammad gave me the Quran to taste. And from the Quranic point of view, all of the means by which God has expressed himself in speech, all of those revelations, and we can say, applying ourselves to certain verses of the Quran, that the Vedas, the revelation of the Sanskrit of the Vedas, the Hebrew of the Old Testament, the Arabic of the Quran, these are all languages which are sacred because God has spoken through them and revealed himself through them. So whatever we say about the theurgy of the Quran applies to at least the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, which is regarded as revelation in the highest sense. And Sanskrit, of course, for the Upanishads, the Vedas, and what the Hindus call Shruti, the highest level of revelation. They all have this theurgic presence, so this is not a claim that's being made exclusively for the Quran. So going back to what Imam Ali said, that God makes himself manifest through his book, he doesn't just send a message down through his book. That sending down is called tanzil, from somewhere up there in heaven to down here on earth, a message is revealed. But when you talk about the tajalli of God through his book, you're talking about the difference between me taking something out of my pocket and showing you what I have concealed from you and now I reveal to you. That's one kind of revelation of something hidden. As opposed to me taking off my jacket, my jumper, my vest, and showing you my breast. That's a kind of tajalli. That's a self-disclosure, as opposed to a revelation of something, of an object about myself. So in the Quran, you have this revelation of a message that previously was hidden, but you also have the disclosure of the very nature of the divine power, the mystery of the presence of God, that actually is transmitted by the sonoral revelation. It's the sound, it's the musicality, it's what Burckhardt referred to as the clearest link between art and right. It's in the fact that the Quran is the archetype of all musicality, as are the other revelations. The Vedas make it even more explicit that Om is the primordial sound from which all sound, where the ragas are also derived. So in the same way, when you hear people in Islamic tradition debating about whether music is haram or halal, it's somewhat laughable to those of us who actually know that the Quranic recitation is itself the most exalted form of music. It's not restricted to what we call music, but it is the archetype of all musical possibilities. So this giving of oneself to the recitation is giving of one's own tajalli to the tajalli of God. When Imam Ali relates these three principles of the Quranic revelation as tajalli, the human being as the microcosm, and the whole of the cosmos as the means by which God reveals himself, you have three modes of tajalli, three modes of self-disclosure. And you can't understand the theurgic, transformative power, the presence of God within the Quran, without understanding that there is something in the human being which is totally receptive to that. And therefore it's, as it were, the Quran, the Kitab Mubin within oneself, that tajalli which one constitutes, that is the essential prerequisite for this power coming through the Quran to be realized as such. Did you want to add something?
I was just going to say, so in terms of its activation as a theurgic entity, are you saying it's contingent upon the person that has the capacity to acknowledge its presence as a theurgic power, or does it happen irrespective of...
It can happen miraculously through a grace that someone who's not cultivated any kind of receptivity to the Quran as the word of God can just be struck by it. I heard that recently that actor Liam Neeson in Turkey, he was absolutely overwhelmed by the sound of the Quran in Turkey, and Muslims everywhere were very excited. They thought he was going to convert. How did that didn't happen? But there are instances like that where people are so struck having nothing but negative images of Islam. But yet when they hear the Quran recited or the azan called out from the mosques, they know that this is otherworldly. This is not just ordinary sound and music singing in this world. So yes, it's contingent to a large degree upon one's receptivity, but it's the principial presence, it's the objective presence within oneself as the tajalli, as the, one of the disclosures of God. And here it's really important verse which I didn't cite here in the text is the verse at the end of the surah Fussilat, which says, "We will show them our signs, our verses, ayat, the same word used for verses of scripture. We shall show them our signs on the horizons around them and in their own souls until it becomes clear to them that He is the truth, that God is the truth." And there you've got the same idea of God's revelations being in oneself as well as in virgin nature, in what's come fresh from the hands of the Creator. And it's that that, in a sense, enables the Muslim, with a certain degree of imagination, to understand how the primordial traditions, shamanisms, how they can decipher the revelation of God through the signs of the virgin nature all around them. So it's these three things that come together: the cosmos, the microcosm, and the Quranic revelation, or revelation of the speech of God, the sound of God, that enable us to understand that what the Quran is takes precedence over what the Quran says. Fridtjof Schoen gives a wonderful analogy. He says that the whole of Quran is like gold. Like the whole, from beginning to end, it's the revealed word of God, and it's pure gold. There are some verses which are more profound than others, and this is like ornaments that you make out of gold that are particularly beautiful, but it doesn't add anything to the value of the gold as such. That value is the same from beginning to end. So even when you're reciting verses that are to do with law or inheritance or punishment or whatever else it may be, the very sound of the Quran is entering, the barakah, the blessings of it, is entering into you. And it has the same potential to transform you as the verses which are more metaphysical or spiritual and so on. I think that's probably all I should say for now on that subject so that we can get to the other two. We'll come to Susanna's asking about the reason why Rustihan says it's the sadness of love that washes away the tears from the eternal beauty of the bride, the face of the eternal beauty of the bride. And actually it's partly related to the question about the Quran, because the idea of the bride, Arus, is very strongly associated with the Quran. Jalaluddin Rumi says that the Quran is like a bride who's veiled, and she will withdraw from any suitor who comes to her in an unworthy manner. And what he means by this is that there's a certain adab, a certain etiquette, a spiritual propriety that you should observe if you're to receive the blessings of the Quran. And Al-Ghazali, the Mullah Sadra, have these lists of preconditions for enhancing receptivity to the Quran. And among them are a intention to read in all of the verses something that applies directly to oneself and not to something external or objective to outside of oneself. One should have the emotion of fear and allow that fear to manifest when one is reading verses of the Quran that pertain to what's called tarhib as opposed to tarhib, and so on and so forth. But the bride is an image that's given by Rumi to explain why it is that some people are able to enter into the Quran spiritually and others are not. One of the most important preconditions is actually purity of heart, purity of intent. And the Quran itself says, "La yamassahu illa mutahharun." No one can touch it, the Quran, except those who have been purified. Exoterically, that means that you have to perform the ablutions to touch the actual text of the Quran. But esoterically, that means you won't be able to really touch the essence of the Quran, its spiritual power, unless you are purifying yourself, unless you are making some effort at doing precisely what Rustihan says about the sadness of love washing away the tears from the face. Meaning that you have to wash away with the sadness of the tears of love. You're washing away the ephemeral dust on the face of the beloved with your sadness. Why is it the sadness of love? Because in this pilgrimage from human love to spiritual love to divine love, inevitably, in that transcendence of the human towards the spiritual and the divine, there is a moment of great sadness that you're leaving behind something to which your soul was attached on the human plane. There's a recognition by the spirit of the intellect, that this soulful attachment to another human being or an object in the world, that soulful attachment to it is like a second skin that you have to peel away. It's an attachment to something created, and it's preventing your spirit from going into the second stage of the journey to see that the spirit of the thing that you love requires you to not just transcend, but sacrifice. To begin with, you sacrifice. You come back to it later. But in the beginning, you have to be prepared to sacrifice the object of love as object. Layla as a woman, as a physical, material, corporeal entity. You have to be prepared in your mind to sacrifice the love that you have for that woman if you are to see through her what she symbolizes. I say at the beginning, there's a sadness of the soul that recognizes it cannot have on its own level the infinite love and the beauty that it's seeking. Something has to be sacrificed, and that sacrifice means tears. Tears of sadness of the love that's taking you higher to the source of that beauty. But then, having found the spiritual love, and then the divine love that transcends the spiritual, through the grace of God lifting you further, because you can to a certain extent make that movement further. first stage of the pilgrimage on the basis of your own, the resources that God has given you. You have an intellect, and with that intellect you discern the archetype of what you love. But then from the spiritual love to the divine love, where it's really God seeing himself through you, that is the result of fana, and fana is something that we can't precipitate. We can't extinguish ourselves. The more we try, the more we entrench the thing we're trying to extinguish. So we can't go any further on our own. But God can take us further. He can extinguish us from our own creaturely consciousness, in which we become transparent veils to his vision of his own beauty. And once that has happened, at the highest level, then there's no longer any sadness. Then the sadness is completely replaced by a celestial joy, a divine intuition, that enables you to see that same beauty in the creature. So you have made the return to the creature love, but now without any idolatry. Now it's a fully spiritual, if not a divine vision you have of the beloved, and it infuses that object with universality and a totality and absoluteness that it lacked when it was being loved for its own sake as a creature, by you as a creature. So there's an initial sacrifice, a transcendence of that through your own effort, and then when God bestows upon you the grace of degrees of extinction, let's say, in the degree that you see through yourself, then God sees through you. He sees through your transparency. And as I say, I think this is one of the most challenging and transformative aspects of Uzbehar's message to us. That it's not just the object of love, the object of beauty, that is to become an icon, a window to the divine. It's also our cognition, our perception. We have to, and this is really based on the Hadith Qudsi, which I didn't mention here, which expresses walaya, that when God loves the slave, it's said in this Hadith Qudsi, that God says, I have made, that my slave approaches me by nothing which I love more than that which I have made incumbent upon him, the legal foundations of Islam, the five pillars. My slave does not cease to draw closer to me by nawafil, by what goes beyond the legal obligations and implies total devotion, the invocation of the divine name, the recitation of the Holy Quran, over and above the legal requirements. And when I love him through these nawafil that he's performing, I am, or I become, the hearing by which he hears, the sight by which he sees, the foot upon which he walks, and the hand by which he smites. So God enters into the faculties of consciousness, as it were. But since God does not change from at one point not being our faculties to another point becoming our faculties, the Sufis understand the saying to actually mean that all that changes is our understanding of what it is that hears and sees, our understanding of the source of our own consciousness, the depth, the immanent root of our own cognition. So it's that insight that Uzbehar is really opening up for us, what it means that God is the source of our consciousness, that he is in fact the hearer, the seer, through us. And just understanding that on a doctrinal level helps us to be detached from the imprisoning aspect of our own thoughts, thinking that it's I, my creaturely resources, and so on. It helps us to be receptive to this transformation of our consciousness so that we can say, without any pride, with Uzbehar, man bar man bi man ashaqahi. It's an astonishing statement that I am in love with myself without myself. That without myself means because of my faqr, my poverty, or my fana, what God has given me, to extinguish myself. But it's the extinction of that extinction that he calls ayyan al-ayyan, the vision of the vision. Most Sufis talk about the vision of certainty being arriving from the haqq al-yaqeen, the reality of certainty. But Uzbehar says that the highest level of tawheed is not simply the vision that we have of one, of the oneness of God, the spiritual vision. It's actually the vision we have of our own vision. It's reflexive. So he understands that, he's helping us to understand, that the vision that we have is nothing other than the vision of God within us. And that we have to see this God seeing through us if we're to be detached from our own creaturely limitations. And I can't help remembering the famous words of the poem of Martin Lings, that no more, I say, would it have been, for I have seen what I have seen, and I have heard what I have heard. So if to tears you see me stir, presume not that they spring from woe. From thankful wonderment they flow. Praise be to him, the Lord, the King, who gives beyond all reckoning. Wonderful words that concludes his self-portrait with the poem called Self-Portrait. And so when he's talking about, I've seen what I've seen, I've heard what I've heard, you can't help feeling that he's actually talking about the same reality. That what he has seen, he's seen with the eye of the divine. And what he has heard, with the hearing of the divine. And he's aware of it. All of us are seeing and hearing through God as the hearer. Seeing, but we're not aware of it. We just are veiled from that reality. There's a verse in the Quran that is a kind of contradiction in terms, but it expresses this very well. It says, لَيْسَ كَمِثْلِهِ شَيْءٍ وَهُوَ السَّمِيعُ الْبَصِيرُ. There is nothing like him, and he is the hearing, the seeing. One might ask, if there's nothing like him, how is it that we can see and hear as well as him? We are hearing beings, we are seeing, the Quran is full of it, we've made you hearing and seeing. So how is it there can be nothing like him when we can hear and we can see like he does? Different, vastly different scale, but nonetheless we are hearers and seers. So the answer is that there is indeed nothing like him. Your seeing is not your own. He is the sole consciousness, not just the sole objective reality, he's the sole subject, the sakshin, the witness, as the Hindus would say. And he is the hearer and the seer through us. So, I think we're running out of time. The third question. The reason why I insist on translating Ar-Rahman and Ar-Rahim as the lovingly compassionate, the lovingly merciful, is that, first of all, the root of the word in Hebrew, Syriac, Aramaic, in those languages, that root, rahama, primarily means love, and secondarily means compassion or mercy. So that one of the names of God in Syriac Christianity was Rahmana, something like that. And it means not the compassionate, but the loving. And so this, the root of the word should be resonant for us when we hear the word Rahman Rahim. We should remember that this was there in the earlier Semitic roots. Secondly, the incident that I refer to justify this translation is the incident at the fall of Mecca when the Prophet and his companions saw a woman running, searching for her baby that had been lost in the middle. And there was no battle, by the way, at the fall of Mecca. This was a peaceful conquest where the Prophet had given amnesty to the whole population of Mecca, the erstwhile persecutors and enemies, who feared that they were going to be killed in retribution for what they had done. The Prophet said, no, you all have an amnesty, and he had a very short list of people who were excluded from that amnesty because of the gravity of the crimes that they committed. But in this peaceful conquest, a woman was seen running looking for her baby. And when she found the baby, she touched it to her breast and fed it. And the Prophet said, do you see how much rahmah this woman has for her baby? They were all remarking upon it. And this is another very important thing as regards, you know, people may say I've exaggerated about love and beauty and tenderness. And were these people really like that, the Prophet and these people winning all these battles and so on and so forth? But you read these sorts of stories and you realize it was really like that for them. They fought with a reluctance. The Prophet said, never seek to fight your enemy. Imam Ali said, never challenge anyone to fight. But when you're challenged, respond. Never be a coward. So you have this, on the way to Mecca, there was a wonderful incident where a bitch had given birth to her puppy. And the Prophet saw it and not only did he say to his troops, be careful not to harm them, but he posted one of the Muslims there to make sure that this army of thousands would not inadvertently harm any of these puppies and the mother. We've got lots and lots of incidents like that to show that أَشِدَّاءُ عَلَى الْكُفَارُ رُحَمَاءُ بَيْنَهُمْ, that they were indeed, they were strong against those who fought them, the enemies, but they were merciful amongst themselves, between themselves, lovingly merciful, one might say. So, the Prophet said, you see how much rahmah this woman has for her baby? And they're all marvelling at this scene, touching scene, of the reassurance of the mother, the joy that she had in feeding her baby, that she thought she'd lost forever. And then the Prophet said that God has more rahmah for you than this woman has for her baby. So in giving us this analogy, he's inviting us to, again on a vastly greater scale, unimaginably greater scale, to see that the relationship that the mother has for her baby is analogous to the relationship that God has for us. And we say to ourselves, what is the single word that defines the relationship between the mother and her baby, especially a newborn baby? You wouldn't say compassion or mercy. You would say organic, all-embracing, total, unreserved, unconditional love. So the rahmah that she shows her child may well comprise compassion and mercy, but it comes from this love. The same way the compassion and mercy that God shows us is rooted in love. And also this maternal idea is very strong because the word rahmah is, in fact there's a hadith Qudsi that says that I derived one of my names from the womb of the mother, the womb of the woman, rahim. I've derived rahman from this. It's the same word that we use today to talk about derivation, etymological derivation, mushtaq. It's actually derived from the word for the womb. So this maternal aspect and loving aspect makes it very difficult for me just to hear people saying compassionate and merciful, because you can have compassion and mercy as a kind of pity, which may not have love accompanying it. But you cannot have love, especially the love of a mother for her child, without that being accompanied by compassion and mercy. So I think we've probably come to the end of our time.